Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode here at the Damage Report. We are very excited today, especially with some of the news that we've got coming up for you today on the program, that I'm going to be joined today by Michael Shore. Welcome back to the program.
Good to be on the Damage Report, Johnny. How are you?
Very glad to have you here, especially because we're going to be talking about some members of Congress, and I can't wait to find out what you know about these that probably no one else, including me, knows. So that's going to be fun. And I can't wait to see your take on Donald Trump's interview yesterday. I think it's going to be a fun one. But anyway, how's the pandemic treating you?
Well, you know, getting through it. There are people in much worse shape than me, so all of my complaints are just idle complaints. But the idle time is really what's tough, and we'll get through it. It's just a depressing thing.
Exactly, it is, and there is dark news today as well. But I just saw Kenny from Philly said, "Time for Captain America of TYT." So apparently, very excited to see you. So that's great. Everyone who's already here in the chat, and it looks like there's several thousand of you who haven't yet hit the like button, which I take as a personal insult. And so if you could do that, that would be great. And feel free to share the stream, let people know, that we're chatting and they can come in. And if you want to send comments, send tweets to hashtag TDR Live, or send in super chats, we'll be responding to those throughout. That said, there is so much news. We should probably jump right into it, Michael. You ready to do this?
I am. I'm ready to do it. I'd love a day, believe it or not, where there wasn't so much news.
Exactly. There have been a couple of days in my time at TYT where it's like, oh, what are we gonna put on the rundown? But it's rare.
Yeah.
It's pretty rare. Okay, let's do this thing. Yesterday, in an interview with Fox News, specifically their medical contributor, Dr. Mark Siegel, Donald Trump brought up, I believe, fully unprompted, once again, his mental competence and the test that he thinks proves that he's all there. Let's just listen to him tell it and decide for ourselves.
And it was 30 or 35 questions. The first questions are very easy. The last questions are much more difficult, like a memory question. It's like you'll go person, woman, man, camera, TV. So they say, could you repeat that? So I said, yeah. So it's person, woman, man, camera, TV. Okay, that's very good. If you get it in order, you get extra points. Okay, now he's asking you other questions. And then 10 minutes, 15, 20 minutes later, they say, remember the first question? Not the first, but the 10th question? Give us that again. Can you do that again? And you go person, woman, man, camera, TV. If you get it in order, you get extra points. They said, nobody gets it in order. It's actually not that easy, but for me, it was easy. And that's not an easy question. In other words, they ask it to you, they give you five names and you have to repeat them, and that's okay. If you repeat them out of order, it's okay, but you know, it's not as good. But then when you go back about 20, 25 minutes later and they say, go back to that question, they don't tell you this, go back to that question and repeat them. Can you do it? And you go, person, woman, man, camera, TV. They say, that's amazing. How did you do that? I do it because I have like a good memory, because I'm cognitively there.
Because I'm cognitively there. It was amazing, Michael. It's pretty amazing.
I've changed my whole thought process around this president. He's very, very impressive, and that I didn't realize until yesterday.
Yeah. So there's, you know, there's the fact that he just keeps bringing it up, and I swear every time he talks about it, he sounds like, I don't know, like I would be concerned if I was a member of his family that he is rambling on in this way. And if you're going to deliver that material, let's say that you had signed a deal with the devil, you got to talk about your MoCat test or whatever on this interview. Okay, then as you're like listing the example five things, don't like stall like you're thinking about it the first time. You
right.
Just made it up. It's not like you're actually remembering anything. For all we know, he is looking around the area and saying the things that he sees.
That he sees right then, yeah.
Yeah, or yeah. Considering that it's woman, camera, TV, it might just be his favorite words that he's just repeating, I don't know. But he's stalling, and saying you get bonus points for doing it in order, You said that the first time, buddy. You don't need to say it again. I remember.
Right, but maybe he's so forgetful, his cognitive order isn't there, so he didn't remember that he just said that.
Maybe. And look, I understand that I'm going to say this at the risk that I am wrong, and thus, I guess I'm not as good on this test as he is. But he lists the five words, and he does it in that clip, I think, three times. I don't want to go through and write them all down, because I feel like that is taking him more seriously than is merited. But I feel like he swapped Cameron Mann. I don't think he got it in the same order all three times. Someone can check. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there's something wrong with me mentally. I don't know. But I'm pretty sure he messed it up.
The only reason I think you're wrong is that it would have been all over Twitter by now.
Yeah.
If that were,
yeah, know, you're so probably right.
I think that he probably got it right. This is like, so talk about TV. This feels like, you know, some crime drama, right? Or a Law and Order, where the lawyer is building this basic case. And so what he's trying to do is talk about how credible he is only because he's thinking about how there is a diminution in skills on the part of his opponent. And he's trying to build his own case. It's just blatant, and it's not impressive.
No, I'm not impressed. You know, but I'm a little bit woozy because I think while listening to that video, I think I suffered a brain bleed. But yeah, he's just very impressed. And the thing is, it's one thing. It's like if the test was administered to you and you didn't know anything about how it's supposed to be used, you could do the test and think, oh my God, I aced this. I'm sure there are people who take dumb internet quizzes and think, man, I got all those state capitals or something. I don't know. But the thing is, to keep saying that the doctors were amazed, and let me show, I believe this next video has a little bit of...
President Putin is sharp. Erdogan is sharp. You don't have any non-sharp people that you're dealing with, and we can't have somebody that's not 100%. So what I did is it's a public test, and he said, you know, if you take this test, we may have to reveal it. I said, it's all right. I mean, is it tough? Tell me about it. I'd never heard of it. And I got a perfect mark. And the doctors were, they said very few people can do that.
So that is perhaps the biggest issue, because I think that there are at least one of two explanations. One is that that didn't actually happen. He's just making that up, which is, you know, really weird. It's disconcerting. The other is that it did happen. That the doctors who were around him did say, oh my God, sir, this is amazing. You aced that thing. You're a genius. And those are like the White House doctors who apparently have been trained to treat him like a child and to pat him on the head for passing a test where passing doesn't mean anything except that you're apparently not suffering from some sort of massive cognitive impairment.
Yeah, I don't believe that. I don't believe that they said that. I the latter part is probably true, that you have a coddling set of White House physicians with a chief physician trying to sort of paint the best picture. But I also don't believe him. I believe they said, you did well. You know, a lot of people don't do as well. And he turned it into, the doctors have never seen anyone do as well on this test. So, he's the great exaggerator. And to that extent, I can't see why he would stop here.
Yeah, perhaps. Now, I feel sort of obligated to give a response to Trump constantly talking about this from a doctor. So here's a quote from Zaya Nesruddin, who said, it's not meant to measure IQ or intellectual skill in any way. If someone performs well, what it means is they can be ruled out for cognitive impairment that comes with diseases like Alzheimer's, stroke, or multiple sclerosis. That's it. But what would he know? He only designed that test. And so to have Trump talking about what it is intended to do, no, the guy who made it can say what it's meant to do. It's not an IQ test. It doesn't. Right. It just means that you don't have like a lesion in your brain that's impairing your short-term memory or something like that. To keep bringing it up. And what I want to ask you is, since you've been through multiple elections as a strategy, he clearly, one of his tactics is, I want to get people to think, when you think of Biden, think his brain is pudding. Is this helping him to make that case?
I've been wrong about, I should preface it by saying, I've been wrong about Donald Trump and what is or is not helping him. In this case, I don't think that this is helping him make that case. I think only Biden can make that case. And I think that Trump can exploit it to a degree. But it is a sidetrack from everything else that's going on of substance. And the polling numbers right now, polling is better in 2020 than it was in 2016. The polling numbers right now are showing that the problems that he's having are on substance. And the what's helping Biden doesn't have to do with that comparison, so, or what's hurting him. And so I don't think it's a good tactic.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, look, when Donald Trump goes on and on and on about his cognitive fitness, it makes me wonder, like, don't Republicans see this and wonder what is wrong with him? Like, Tucker Carlson throws to that interview that everybody's now talking about, comes back from it, and pretends that what he saw wasn't deeply embarrassing or concerning. But the thing is, it is Fox News. And so not long after Dr. Siegel, he goes this morning on Fox and Friends to talk about that. And I had been wondering, what does this doctor think after facing down Trump, who's rambling about five words, persons and mans and cameras and TVs and all of that? Turns out he was impressed.
Well, you know, he discussed the issue of his own clarity of vision. And I did, in a sense, that interview was a cognitive test, Ainsley. I have to tell you, as you know, he is extremely sharp on every second. And he did a test on TV where he basically, you know, went through how great his memory is. And what he said was, even all of the major leaders of the world, Ainsley, he talked about Putin, he talked about Chairman Xi, he said that whatever you think of them, they're extremely sharp. And we need a leader that has that level of awareness and sharpness.
Dr.
And that
Siegel.
Applies to the election.
So, and again, the funny thing is, Trump brings up the test without it being prompted. Fox and Friends, they hadn't asked Dr. Siegel about the test. He was like, what does he say about the election? And that is what Siegel went to, that he stared into that open flapping jaw saying person, camera, man, TV over and over and over again. And he came away thinking, no, this guy is very sharp as Putin and other world leaders, and this is who we need.
Well,
and he's a doctor.
In fairness, and I don't need to be terribly fair to this guy who should have led with something different, he did go on to say that the election, that applies to the election, so someone with great cognitive strength would be able to sit down and see what they're framing.
Yes.
But you know, there you asked a question like, will this have good effect? I mean, they're speaking in front of an audience that really doesn't need to be convinced. And the people that the president needs to convince to either vote for him again who do not want to, or to give him a shot, those are people that are not going to be impressed by this. Those are people who are going to sort of be, I think, some flabbergasted by the fact that this is what went on TV. So I do see why, you know, why they're painting this picture, but I don't think it's to great effect.
Yeah. Yeah. And look, they're always going to defend him. I guess to sort of so go on.
Yeah, I was going to add that, you know, there in the Carter Reagan, there's a famous Carter Reagan debate in 1980 where, you know, Reagan eventually won. But they were talking about how old Ronald Reagan was. And he had this great debate moment, which you can go back and see, where he said, I will not allow my opponent to exploit his youth and inexperience. So he turned it on Carter. Right. I imagine that Biden's going to have some kind of moment in a debate, if whatever debates look like, where there's going to be a line about that, about, you know, experience versus, you know, cognitive ability. I don't know what it is yet, obviously, but I think that they're going to, that the Biden people have to kind of own this and laugh at it too.
Yeah, maybe. And really fast, just because I'm not sure that we've talked specifically about this. There's a couple of ways that I think that Trump has tried to make the 2020 election very similar to 2016. One was corruption, the Ukraine thing and everything, and that doesn't seem to really be taking. And the other is trying to have everyone associate the candidate with these negative characteristics. And he was certainly able to do that with Hillary Clinton. He doesn't seem to be having as much success with Joe Biden. When you poll people about cognitive fitness, they think that Biden is doing better than Donald Trump. Do you think that something will stick, or do you think that there are fundamental differences between Biden and Clinton that make that a harder strategy to have succeed?
It's the perception of Biden and Clinton that the where the fundamental differences lie. So, you know, Hillary Clinton came in with a lot of Americans disliking her and disliking her with great ferocity in some circles. So it's hard to get to home plate when you're on first base, right? And Joe Biden is on third base. Whether you love his politics, whether you're a progressive Democrat who thinks he's essentially a Republican, or whether you're a Republican who thinks he's the most liberal person who's come across, Joe Biden is still a liked person in most circles. And I think that that's part of what makes it very difficult for these sort of negative attacks to be put on someone who is actually quite popular. Very quickly, you go back to Kamala Harris in that first debate when she went and attacked Joe Biden effectively at that time about busing and his positions on busing. Joe Biden was sort of a deer in the headlights. Nobody has really been mean to Joe Biden in a very long time in a very public way. He got used to that during the primaries. I imagine he'll be better at that during the election, during the general election. It's going to be very frustrating for Donald Trump, I think.
It might be. I'm sort of dreading the debates because, you know, they were a horrific experience the last time around, 2016. And, you know, considering the way the polling is looking, it seems like, I mean, I don't think the conventions are going to produce the strong bounce that they normally do, being all virtual and all of that. It seems like other than some big international event, which it's entirely possible Donald Trump will attempt to pull out of thin air, that's like the big thing that could shift things. I don't think that they necessarily typically do significantly, but that's one of the few things remaining in the last 102 days before the election.
Yeah, I suspect you're right. If anything, that could happen. But I also think because of the way that we are going to take them in, because of the way that there's no campaigning, it'll still be different. But I think, yes, they could have a negative effect. They could also have, and people always forget this, they could have a positive effect. Joe Biden could actually, you know, be somebody who is comforting. You always, not you, John Iderola, but people always think, oh, how could this hurt? How could this hurt? You know, it could also help. And
that's
I
true.
Think that's important to remember.
Yeah. Donald Trump announced yesterday a big new campaign strategy of his. He's going to be invading a number of different U.S. cities.
Today, I'm announcing a surge of federal law enforcement into American communities plagued by violent crime. We'll work every single day to restore public safety, protect our nation's children, and bring violent perpetrators to justice.
Okay, and so if you've been watching the footage coming out of Portland, and that scared you, get ready, because it's coming to a number of other cities. He already previewed earlier this week that you can expect these sorts of things in Chicago, Philadelphia, Detroit, Baltimore, Oakland, and others. And all of the relevant people in the federal government who would be involved in that have confirmed that this is happening. This isn't just Donald Trump's, you know, or regular hyperbole. They're going to be sending these generally unmarked, camouflaged soldiers from a variety of different agencies. And to defend statues, but seemingly to instigate conflicts and then brutally oppress protesters in these cities. What do you think, Michael?
Yeah, I think this is also baldly political, and I think it's a miscalculation. First, I should say I will be bothered all day and probably tomorrow by the fact that I said it was Carter and not Mondale. But
It's okay.
We'll have to move past it because, you know, insert noun here, insert noun, move forward. I think that, you know, every, you know, people that are advising Donald Trump, and I know some of them and haven't spoken to them for a little while, but they you know, the idea that he's fighting something is very important to him. And his fighting the virus has not gone very well. So if he's going to be a wartime president going into an election, he's got to create that war. And the way he's doing it, it doesn't seem he's going to Democratic states, but Oregon at one time was a state that they were going to make a play for because he does need to win in places that he didn't win last time, especially if he's going to lose in places that he did. And I think that, you know, going into these Democratic states to show up Democratic governors and sometimes Democratic mayors, it seems like a complete miscalculation, because what it does is it sets up this kind of real enemy of the state type of arrangement. Also, the people that are in the middle are generally people that don't like too much government, and this is to the nth degree too much government. So the calculation politically seems curious to me as well. You know, first of all, it's scary on a personal level. It's the most un-American thing I remember a president doing, probably since immigration. But you know, this kind of blatant force into cities that aren't asking for it, it's terrifying stuff. Yeah. I also think it's not going to work.
Yeah, aren't asking for it or specifically saying don't do it or get right. out of our city if you're already there. And he just doesn't care. He wants to manufacture this image that he believes will sufficiently scare Republicans to potentially keep him in office. And we know that in Portland, the protests had more violence once those soldiers were deployed there. They were relatively unmarked by those sorts of things beforehand. And now you can expect that in a lot of different cities. And I don't see as a campaign strategy why this would work when his brutal, uncaring attitude towards the protests from the very beginning didn't help him. Why would instigating new rounds of that do better? Like, you've seen the footage. Now that's going to be coming out of many different cities, and he's going to be responsible.
But every day you see that footage, you're not seeing coronavirus. You're not seeing the failures of this administration. You're not seeing huge unemployment numbers. You know, we just got new employment numbers that went up for the first time since they started going down. These are not good times to be president when you're this president. So what do? You divert as much attention as you can. Perhaps you set it up in a way that you can use it as a debate. Joe Biden had the crime bill. All of a sudden, though, this makes the crime bill look soft, right? And Joe Biden can say, if I see problems in the state, I'm going to go to Mayor Lightfoot in Chicago, for example, and I'm going to say, Mayor, if our help is here, if you need it, tell us how we can help rather than we're coming. And that's something that can be used tactically.
Yeah. And by the way, I'm glad that you mentioned the crime bill, because he's having trouble trying to make the election about these personality characteristics and mental characteristics. He hypothetically could, in the same way that people like Bernie Sanders did in the primary, try to make it about the substance of mistakes that Joe Biden has made in office. And that's something that Trump would have a chance of doing, since Trump hasn't been in elected office for a very long time. If he had been a senator when we were making the decision to go to war in Iraq, he would definitely have voted for it. But he thankfully, blessedly, wasn't a senator, so he didn't have to. But so he could differentiate himself, and with things like the crime bill. But as you point out, he's simultaneously criticizing Biden for things like that, but then trying to prove that he is more harsh, more uncaring, less willing to talk about reform. It is a nonsensical strategy at best, and along the way, incredibly damaging, both to, norms and, our conception of how durable the Constitution and our rights will be, but also to the people whose heads are getting cracked open and the moms are getting gassed on a nightly basis and all of that. And now we can expect many times as much of that as he deploys to more and more cities.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the primaries until right now, this has not been a debate that's been about substance. It's not been a debate that's been about legislation. It's been about a president that many people don't like, who has bad approval ratings. And the Democrats selected the person that they thought would have the best chance of winning. I don't disagree with them, and that would put me at odds with a lot of people probably watching this right now. But whether or not I'm right or they're right, it doesn't matter. The point is, this is where we are, and the president has an opportunity to try and go through Joe Biden and do it that way. Instead, he's taking some of the things that Joe Biden might be worse on, and he is taking them and just making them bigger, and really sort of doing a favor to Joe Biden by numbing the effect that his past votes as a senator might have had on this campaign. And I mean, it's a gift to Biden in a sense, yeah. And we'll see if it even matters.
Yeah. Just I worry, like, it, so far, like, there's been horrible injuries in Portland, but Tom Cotton was on Sean Hannity two nights ago. And said, and Sean Hannity was like, well, if they start shooting at the protesters and they kill some, whose fault will it be? And Tom Cotton's like, well, ultimately, it's with the criminals. Like, he responded to the possibility that these soldiers could end up killing, potentially massacring protesters with, what are you going to do? It's on them. He's a senator.
Right, well, that's the same idea about the police, right? It's always on the criminals, right? The people that say, well, George Floyd was passing a $20 counterfeit bill. He should, had it come,
Exactly.
It's a really skewed way of looking at the world.
Donald Trump has been trying for a few years now to employ the census to strike out against undocumented immigrants and try to artificially increase the political power of Republicans, who are finding it more difficult nationally and in a number of different states to compete with changing demographics and all of that. And so, despite losing multiple times in efforts to employ a citizenship question on the census and things like that. He made this announcement yesterday in a memorandum on excluding, in his words, illegal aliens from the census, saying, "I have accordingly determined that respect for the law and protection of the integrity of the democratic process warrant the exclusion of illegal aliens from the apportionment base to the extent feasible and to the maximum extent of the president's discretion under the law," saying that although the Constitution is 100% clear that you being a citizen has nothing to do with whether you're counted for the census for the purposes of apportionment of political power and seats, they're not going to count them. Now, there's a couple of issues with that, which we'll get into. But Michael, thoughts?
Again, this is just like the last story. It's a distraction. It's going back to the bread and butter of the 2016 campaign. It's going back to the wall, which he says is now built. It's talking about immigration and the other. It really is trying to divide the country because he thinks that works for him politically. It has. You understand why he would do it. But again, there's a little bit about this that has to do with the law, and the court has ruled on it, and it is in the Constitution. So this president by fiat can't just go ahead and demand this, but he can certainly make that statement and have people hear it and understand whose side he's on.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, kick up a little dust, maybe, you know, cause a couple of legal battles that maybe set back various efforts, slow things down. We don't know. But again, just in case, you know, there's a big Trump fan who's watching this and doesn't get it and doesn't get how cut and dry this is, the 14th Amendment to the Constitution provides that, quote, "Representatives shall be apportioned among the several states according to their respective numbers, counting the whole number of persons in each state, excluding Indians not taxed." That's not ambiguous. I understand that, like, the clear text of the Constitution can be very confusing to some people. You can take a look at something as simple as the Second Amendment and not get half of it. I get that. But that's pretty clear. There are other issues. For instance, the fact that the census is almost two-thirds complete. And it's not gathering information on citizenship or legal status. And that's, I think we're at 62.2%. So here is the issue with that. You might think, well, how are you going to do this when we're already like two-thirds through and none of that information is being gathered? Well, they have a plan. So they're not going to be stopped by the fact that they don't know what the numbers of undocumented immigrants are in these areas. They have a section of the memorandum, which I'm going to show you, that is instructing executive departments and agencies to share information with the Department of Commerce, to the extent permissible, blah, 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 to obtain accurate data on the number of citizens, non-citizens, and illegal aliens in the country. As the Attorney General and I explained at the time that order was signed, data on illegal aliens could be relevant for the purpose of conducting the apportionment. So they are not going to be bound. If this goes through and if it's successful, which I can't imagine how it would be except the makeup of the Supreme Court, they're not going to be bound by the count that the census does. They're going to take those numbers, they're going to come up with some number for undocumented immigrants, and then they're going to subtract it, even though that's not what the census found. And who thinks that we could trust them to do that in a way that would not be politically expedient and beneficial to themselves?
Yeah, and this is a legal workaround completely to try and get past a ruling that the court handed down that said that they have to take these pieces of information, or they're not allowed to ask a question on the census about citizenship. So this is the legal workaround to that. The other thing that this does is it probably cows many illegal immigrants, if you want to call them that, in this country, but immigrants who are undocumented, from participating because of the scare tactics involved in all of this rhetoric. And that's the big effect of this as well, is that it does mute them. For example, California, while the nation is at 62 and change percent reported, California is just over 51%. Mm-hmm. So knowing that there are so many undocumented here in the country, but also in the state of California, you can see that there is a scare tactic that's working to an extent as well.
Yeah. Well, it will be challenged. The director of the ACLU's Voting Rights Project says Trump's latest attempt to weaponize the census for an attack on immigrant communities will be found unconstitutional. We'll see him in court and win again. I know that, you know, the makeup of the court has become a little bit darker in recent years, a little bit scarier. But we have had some 5-4 decisions that have gone, you know, in the sense of rationality. Do you think that this is too clear-cut for the Supreme Court to say otherwise, or is it just too appealing a change for conservatives to make?
When you've seen the way that the conservatives have left, and I'm not a court expert, I'm sort of a layperson when it comes to the law in terms and that to that level. But I think when you see the way that they've been reading the textual interpretation, which I guess is an interpretation, the textual reading of the Constitution, the conservatives like Roberts and Gorsuch, anyway, in the small sample we've had from Gorsuch, they read the text and they hold to the text in a way that would be encouraging if you think that the president's off his rocker on this. So I think that's what is important.
I hope so. It's consequential. I mean, think about all of the different layers of manipulation that Republicans mm-hmm. have used to maintain the power they have right now. You know, just from the structural, like the makeup of the Senate, for instance, the way that, you know, political power is apportioned through the Senate, to gerrymandering and all of that, the idea that they would, in one slice, potentially cut multiple seats out just by making up, you know, whatever numbers they want. Because the thing is, we don't actually know how many undocumented immigrants there are in every area, or how, or whether a particular individual is still there or has moved. We have ideas. There are estimates that vary widely. And again, if you could trust, if you couldn't trust one person to come up with an estimate that would be unbiased and fair, which you can't do any of this to begin with, but if you were going to do that, who would trust literally anyone? You're going to have Stephen Miller working on that. It's madness, and it can't be allowed.
It can't be allowed. I'm optimistic on this. I'm not optimistic on all of it, but I'm optimistic on this.
Okay. Donald Trump. He's got his new tone, everybody, this week that the media is so happy to give him. So he now thinks that it's an okay idea if you want to wear a mask. But Kellyanne Conway, she is coming out and saying that not only is Donald Trump now saying that you should wear a mask, but he was actually ahead on this topic, ahead of all of these Democrats that want to claim that they were serious when it came to masks. Here's what she had to say.
He set many examples. He has said many things about, he said in April, if people want to wear a mask, they should wear a mask. He said that. And you got to go back and pull it. I think it's very honest if you're not putting that as part of your reporting. He was way ahead of other people on that. Adam Schiff was still, you know, in his basement looking for collusion and nonsense. Biden's been in his basement. And again, I really think it's important to recognize that this president has presented members of his task force, the doctors of the task force, not just out into the public talking to the press, ladies and gentlemen, but also testifying under oath on Capitol Hill again and again and again. They've all been asked about masks. They've all answered that question. They're there on behalf of the government. They're there on behalf of the task force and it's the press.
So, Donald Trump has always been great on masks. I mean, after all, early on he said, if you want to wear one, you can wear one, which would seem to follow naturally without the president needing to acknowledge that you're free to put cloth over your face. Isn't the same.
Leadership. Man, that is leadership.
It is. You've seen a lot of leaders, Michael. Do you think that Trump isn't getting enough credit?
Yeah, it frustrates the hell out of me when people aren't giving him the credit he deserves for telling us to wear masks all the time when we're out. I think this is absurd, but I do think this speaks to the people that support Donald Trump, that they will believe whatever comes out of that little plot of land in the United States. That what, you know, if you have Kellyanne Conway or Kayleigh McEnany, and I don't know how you confuse them, Josh. That's weird, John. But the
confuse me.
The whole notion that we have this idea that you can say these things and they go unchecked by the people who want to believe them is part of their success. And so they'll keep doing it. And we should, you know, stop being less surprised, but we should keep pointing it out.
Yeah. Yeah. And like him saying that you can if you want to, but then refusing to over and over and over again.
You can if you want to. I mean, of course you can if you want to, right? I mean, you could have done that before there was a pandemic. Sometimes you
say it anytime.
Masks, yeah. You know,
you could wear a scary movie mask if you want to. I could wear a fedora if I want to. I don't, and I shouldn't. But I could. That doesn't mean anything. He kept going. He went to a place that was making PPE and spoiled a batch because he refused to wear a mask. What a fraud. Like, again, I was going to call her Kayleigh McEnany. Kellyanne Conway, like, I know it's politics, and I know that I really have to shed the last bit of this naive approach. But, like, how could you say something like that? You know full well what his position on masks have been, to pretend that he was an advocate for their use when they were mocking how Biden looks in his mask. And he was saying, oh, yeah, it's going to look great when I'm meeting the king of some country wearing a mask. Yeah, no, I'm sure the king would appreciate it, by the way. He'll be wearing one.
Right.
It's just so fake.
And then to say the Schiff and Biden, I mean, I don't know how that's resonating either. You know, oh, Adam Schiff is in his basement.
Yeah, I don't know what that is.
You know, yeah.
I don't know. But the second part of what she said was, not only did he say you can wear a mask if you want to, but he also had members of the coronavirus task force testify, which is technically true. And I went back and looked at a little bit of that testimony and the response from the White House, because you're going to be shocked to find out they didn't want it to happen when it happened. And things like, well, they had good reason, because in the end, Fauci ended up debunking a number of Trump's favorite coronavirus lies. For instance, talking about the idea that the virus will just disappear, he said, I've said publicly many times that this is just not going to happen because it's such a highly transmissible virus. Or, for instance, when Mitt Romney asked him about the fact that Trump says that President Obama is responsible for our lack of a vaccine for a disease we didn't have yet. And he says, well, was Obama or Trump responsible for that? And Fauci said, no, Senator, not at all. And so at the end, not so surprisingly, Trump criticized Fauci for that testimony. So it is a weird rewriting of history to point to testimony they didn't want to happen and then attacked him after four attacks that continue to this week as evidence that he takes this seriously.
That was great show prep, John, because that's so true. I mean, when you look at the way this has gone, that's perfectly according to script. Every single time that one of his lieutenants is marched up to Capitol Hill to speak, and whether they like the president or not, they're always called out on the fact that of what's going on vis-a-vis masks, the addressing of the virus from the White House. And the president, whenever he disagrees with something that doesn't look good or wants to do it, he calls someone out for it. It's been a pattern from the very beginning since they've been going to the Hill.
Yeah. And by the way, in terms of how serious he is and the new tone, and he's really turned a corner on this coronavirus thing and all that, his interview with Dr. Siegel last night, what people are focusing on, and I totally understand why we led with it, was the five words, the TV and the man and the woman and all of that. But do you know what else he said? He was talking about testing. He called testing overrated. Not 3 months ago or a month ago, last night he called it overrated and said it would be better if we did half as much testing because then we'd have half as many cases.
Not the first time he said that in the past week either. I mean, it's a continued theme. And again, he's running for president and he thinks, and he's being told that this message somehow works with the people that support him. It may. And it may be smart politics, but he needs more than the people who already support him.
Yeah.
And that's why I find that it's so short-sighted on the political side of his administration. They got rid of Brad Parscale. Maybe things will change, but they didn't last night. You know, and I don't know. It makes no sense to me just from an objective political thing. It's hard for me to be objective about Donald Trump. But when I try and do that, I still don't understand.
I agree. And again, if maybe there's critics or whatever, it's not just a rhetoric thing with him saying we do too much testing. In the negotiations going on right now, the White House tried to block money for the CDC, for the Pentagon to do coronavirus tracing and things like that. They are literally trying to stop the testing from happening. Joni Ernst was interviewed recently. She's up for re-election. She was asked about a couple different situations having to do with potential openings on the Supreme Court. Now, we know that despite all of what was said by Mitch McConnell during the last year of the Obama presidency and the fact that they blocked Merrick Garland, that if they get their chance before the election, it doesn't matter if it's 2 hours before the vote, they're definitely going to put someone in. But she was asked a more specific question. What if Trump loses the election? And what if the Republicans lose their majority? What if the American people speak uniformly saying, we don't want you all in charge? What happens if a seat opens up then?
different here is it could happen during that lame duck. We're talking about Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Mm-hmm. She announced again she's ill with cancer. If President Trump is defeated, if Republicans lose control of the Senate, would you still support doing this prior to January?
Well, one, I wish nothing but the best of health for Ruth Bader Ginsburg. I think we all do, and I'll be praying for her. And it is a lame duck session. I would support going ahead with any hearings that we might have. And if it comes to an appointment prior to the end of the year, I would be supportive of that. We would need to have some very serious discussion about that. But again, it is, even though it's a lame duck session, it is still a Republican president and still a Republican Senate.
They'd have very serious discussions, you know, somber tones. And they just think about, like, should we actually do this? I wonder. No, they'd pop champagne and set off fireworks inside the Capitol. You surprised at all, or is this just par for the course?
It's par for the course. I'm surprised politically that Joni Ernst, who's in a race that's not, that should be less tight for her in Iowa in 2020, would do that, would say something like that. By the way, a shout out to David Yepsen, formerly of the Des Moines Register, who was doing that interview as part of that panel. He was sort of the guru of politics for a long time. And he's been on TYT with me, so that's why I'm saying.
Oh, that's awesome. I
think that the Senate would not vote to confirm, even though you say there's champagne and you know, I don't think a lame duck Susan Collins or Mitt Romney, I think they would have a handful of votes that would say we shouldn't proceed with this. But of course, I could be the most naive.
You think Susan Collins?
I think Susan Collins.
Really?
Yeah, I do. I mean, in terms of proceeding with it, I just think that they would be voices against proceeding. John, I may be 100% wrong, but I don't. I think, you know, I know some of these senators mildly, and I just don't think that they would, a handful of them anyway, would want to proceed with this because of what it looks like for the party. I think most of them would, and I think that, you know, it might happen. I don't understand in a bigger picture way, because I could be wrong about that, just sort of like reading the Constitution and inventing things that aren't in it, saying, you know, well, now we have a Republican president and a Republican Senate, so of course we're bound to do that. Mm-hmm. It's not said anywhere that that's the case. And it was also looked at recently under Merrick Garland. They looked at all the constitutionality of appointment, of confirmation, all of that. And she's just inventing some rule that she decided helps her out here. But I don't know that it helps her out.
Well, and it would be bad enough if it was just inventing a rule. But they invent different rules based on what the situation tends to be.
Of course, that's what I mean. Yeah. I mean, constantly. We just talked about one with the census, right? I mean, so here's now the Ernst Amendment, which has already apparently passed and is in the Constitution.
Even specifically in this situation, Mitch McConnell was saying we can't have these hearings because the people need to have their voices heard. Because an election is coming up sometime this year. It doesn't matter that the Democrats won the last election. It needs to be heard. So her situation is the hardest test of that. The people have been heard. You lost the presidency. You lost the Senate. Should we go by their will and allow a Democrat? No. And Mitch McConnell would, of course, agree with her. There's no principle there whatsoever. Right. And if it ends up, if somehow, like, I don't know, if, okay, so Biden becomes president, the Democrats take the Senate, it's the last year of the Biden presidency. Well, now by your rules, they hold both things. Are you going to let a hearing go by? No, Mitch McConnell, if he's still around, isn't going to let that happen either. In the way,
I mean, it's clear they're going to have to write some kind of a rule once Biden's president. They're going to have to put some, or the Democrats win the Senate. They're going to have to put something in there, a Senate rule, which can be changed, saying that, you know, within 100 days of an election on either side, 50 days or 90 days, whatever it is, on either side of an election, you cannot have the nomination of a Supreme Court justice. I mean,
yeah, the only thing is the Democrats write that and abide by it. When the Republicans take over the Senate, they're not going to abide by that. They'll change the rule and they'll.
No, you're right. You're right. But something has to give on this because it's so given to interpretation. Again, also, it's only happened. You know, Ruth Bader Ginsburg is still on the court and she's still working.
Yeah,
it's only happened that I remember during Merrick Garland. That there's probably other precedent for it. There was, but was cited, actually, at that time.
Let's just bear in mind one additional thing. I believe Ted Cruz was one of at least two Republican senators, maybe you can remember, who in advance of the election said, no, if Hillary Clinton wins, we're not going to hold hearings.
Right.
Maybe ever for Merrick Garland. That was not a principle of let the people speak. That's if the people speak and we don't like what they're saying, we're still going to have eight justices.
Yeah. Again, these are one of 100, right, or one of 53 on the Republican side. And so it doesn't mean that that's what they all believe. She was asked this on the spot. She didn't seem prepared to answer it, actually, because whenever they start going into the I'm going to pray for Ruth Bader Ginsburg, that's a stall tactic to me. So she, I think, was sort of thinking on her feet there. And I think that other senators will be more prepared with a better answer now that she was the guinea pig here. But I, you know,
maybe
hopefully she's not in the Senate. So
one final thing I would say was in trying to interpret, like predict what Susan Collins would do in that scenario, I think we should factor in that there's a very good chance that in that scenario, she is herself a lame duck senator.
No. I'm saying that fully, you know.
Oh, okay.
So you like, I mean, I don't think she would be vindictive, but there is a, I just, again, it's a gut feeling. I you know, how many times have I thought, I didn't think Susan Collins was going to do us any favors on Kavanaugh. I never believed it. I find her to be, you know, deplorable in that way. But I do think that she and others would, and maybe she wouldn't be one of them, but I think there'd be enough senators to make it so they wouldn't do it.
Over the past few days, we've been dealing with a situation wherein Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez was apparently accosted by a Republican representative, Ted Yoho, outside of the Capitol building, where he used incredibly inflammatory language to and about her. Yesterday, he gave what passes for an apology for a Republican congressman, wherein he didn't even mention what he had said or who he had said it to. And now today we have AOC, who took to the House floor to address the entirety of this. And we have a couple of videos we want to show you. It is powerful stuff, starting with she relays what actually happened, the initial confrontation, then going into vote, and then what happened after that.
I walked back out, and there were reporters in the front of the Capitol. And in front of reporters, Representative Yoho called me, and I quote, bitch. These are the words that Representative Yoho levied against a congresswoman who represents New York's 14th congressional district, but every congresswoman and every woman in this country, because all of us have had to deal with this in some form, some way, some shape, at some point in our lives. And I want to be clear that Representative Yoho's comments were not deeply hurtful or piercing to me, because I have worked a working class job. I have waited tables in restaurants. I have ridden the subway. I have walked the streets in New York City. And this kind of language is not new.
So we definitely have more. I had expected that with his embarrassing display with what passes for an apology, that that would be the end of it, that we wouldn't hear from her. But I'm very glad that we did. What do you think about the back and forth there? I know you have more knowledge about Yoho than I do.
Well, I mean, forgetting Ted Yoho, he's a backbencher. He's an unimpressive member of Congress. He ran for speaker, actually, some time ago. He got two votes when he ran for speaker, probably one from himself. But he's, you know, he's a piece of dust in the Congress. You know, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez there is doing what a lot of people haven't done, which is call people out for the false apology. Right. I mean, if you heard Congressman Yoho's apology, you would have. I heard it. And I was like, what? He didn't apologize and he didn't mention her name. So I think that this is less about Ted Yoho than it is about in general, you know, you standing up for women and standing up for her female colleagues as well. And I think that was the great effect of this. And I'm sure everybody's really happy she did it. It was very impressive.
Exactly. And, you know, as you alluded to, that she didn't make it just about him and her. Basically, she talked about him as a representative of a culture where this is a universal, not just for congresswomen, but for all women. And I want to turn to that section now.
And that's when we start to see that this issue is not about one incident. It is cultural. It is a culture of lack of impunity, of accepting of violence and violent language against women, and an entire structure of power that supports that. Because not only have I been spoken to disrespectfully, particularly by members of the Republican Party and elected officials in the Republican Party, not just here, but the President of the United States last year told me to go home to another country with the implication that I don't even belong in America.
She also mentions, I think it might have been DeSantis that called her a whatever she is or something like that, some other weird dehumanizing phrase. And we've seen that against AOC, against other new congresswomen like Ilhan Omar and Rashida Tlaib and others. This idea that you can, without consequences, viciously attack them, demonize them, otherize them. And that not even without consequences, but in fact, positive consequences. That if you're a member of right-wing media and you do this, you'll get more viewers. If you're a right-wing politician and you do this, you'll be considered more of like a fighter for conservative values and things like that. It's horrifying, and it's there. It's what they have right now in modern-day Republican identity politics. Attacking women like AOC is just about all they have.
I think it's important that we also point out that it was a good week for women standing up on Capitol Hill in a way that you wouldn't expect, which is that Republicans attacked one of their own in Liz Cheney. And we don't have a lot of nice things to say about the politics of Liz Cheney, but she stood up to those attacks. And so did Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. And I think that when you see these two members of Congress who could not be from more polar opposite points of view going at people within their own body, all of them Republican, it speaks volumes about how, you know, we're not going to take it anymore is maybe taking hold in some circles.
Yeah. There's just there's one more section of video I want to play you. This is where she addresses the content of Yoho's apology. She gets into what he actually said.
And I do not need Representative Yoho to apologize to me. Clearly, he does not want to. Clearly, when given the opportunity, he will not. And I will not stay up late at night waiting for an apology from a man who has no remorse over calling women and using abusive language towards women. But what I do have issue with is using women, our wives and daughters, as shields and excuses for poor behavior. Mr. Yoho mentioned that he has a wife and two daughters. I am 2 years younger than Mr. Yoho's youngest daughter. I am someone's daughter too. My father, thankfully, is not alive to see how Mr. Yoho treated his daughter. My mother got to see Mr. Yoho's disrespect on the floor of this house towards me on television. And I am here because I have to show my parents that I am their daughter and that they did not raise me to accept abuse from men.
It's just, it's incredibly powerful. And you know, she followed it up saying things to the content of his excuses, saying that, well, no, he couldn't have done this because he knows women. She says, having a daughter does not make a man decent. Having a wife does not make a decent man. Treating people with dignity and respect makes a decent man. And she sort of concluded saying, lastly, what I want to express to Mr. Yoho is gratitude. I want to thank him for showing the world that you can be a powerful man and accost women. You can have daughters and accost women without remorse. You can be married and accost women. That none of these things that they try to hold up as sort of like, I don't know, sigils against the accusation that they could be misogynist, none of it's true. And she experiences it on a daily basis.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's not, I mean, it's certainly by coincidence, but last night when the house was gaveled out, it was after about 3 hours of memorial to John Lewis and people talking about good trouble, speaking out, speaking truth. And then Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez comes to the well of the Congress and does that today. It's totally taking a baton. And it was really thrilling in the context of the Congress to see that as well.
Yeah. Scott Fleming just sent a super chat that says they bolt the mic in so she can't drop it on them. That's good. Yeah, and I liked seeing Representative Jayapal, and I think Representative Presley. It was just about when we were about to go live. Standing up and supporting her as well. It's what we've been saying since the beginning, since before they were even sworn in. Republicans, a lot of them, whether elected or in the media, just can't take women like this. And sorry, but they're going to become more common.
So. No, but John, I know you're on a schedule and you had to move on and everything, but the stuff about Liz Cheney and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez in the same week is really really important, because they in a concerted effort, the Freedom Caucus went into the Republican luncheon and they just blasted Liz Cheney. Like it was a coordinated attack, and she stood up to them and she fought back to them. And I've never liked a thing I've heard or known about Liz Cheney, not one. But in the same week that you have this happen with Ted Yoho and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, it's pretty cool to see women from both ends of the spectrum that way.
Yes. Yes. Let's give that credit to Liz Cheney and then no more ever again. I totally agree. For weeks now, we have been wondering what is going to happen when the enhanced unemployment benefit goes away. That benefit being, for many Americans, tens of millions, the majority of the entire aid that they've gotten from the federal government during the worst domestic crisis that we've had during the entirety of my life and longer. It's a one-time payment and $600 a week coming from the federal government if you were unemployed, as many, many were. And we're now seeing, by the way, as of today, more unemployment claims coming in as the economy suffers the obvious damage of doing basically nothing to actually fight the pandemic. You can try to reopen, but you can't make it safe if you don't actually do anything about the virus. And so we've been wondering, are they going to extend these unemployment benefits, or are they going to make the incredibly cruel decision to just cut it off? And they found something sort of in the middle, but leaning towards cruel. According to reports that I'm seeing, including from CNBC, the GOP is considering extending the unemployment benefit at $100 a week, cutting it from $600 down to $100 for people who might have been out of work for literally months now, who are facing the possibility of soon being evicted or, having their homes foreclosed upon. $100, Michael Shore.
Yeah, it's clearly not enough. It's embarrassing. Maybe it's a starting off point. The point is, the Democrats want this extended at $600. They don't want it to be temporary. They want it to be that way until the end of the year. A couple of things. Yes, it's probably preventing a good number of people from going back to work. Were there jobs, right? There aren't jobs. You see the unemployment rates going higher. Businesses are still closed, and we are regressing as far as it comes to COVID right now. So how can you say it's preventing you go back to a job that doesn't exist? It's putting money into an economy that wouldn't otherwise be there. It's preventing foreclosures. It's preventing rent being behind on rent. It's getting medical bills paid, credit card bills paid, and it's putting money into the economy. Without those dollars, the money would not be in the economy. Mm-hmm. They're using a poll. 639 people were polled. 18% said that they would rather be on this unemployment. It's stopping them from going back to their job or looking for more work. It's an absurd thing to take one poll and have it be on that. The point is that there are not jobs to go back to. The money goes back into the economy. This is all that is keeping many Americans afloat. And like welfare, if there are some people that are using it in nefarious ways or staying on it, it's worth that to have the other people, the other 80%, 82% in that poll, be able to get by and help them out. So I think the sacrifice is worth the reward here. I think it's an absurd and insulting and politically deaf thing for the Republicans.
I definitely think so. I want to turn to that in one sec. But before that, though, so they're focused on this. What are the incentives for people? Are they going to go back to work? And they've decided we're going to talk about one potential incentive, and that is, are they temporarily making as much or maybe slightly more than they were making? Now, I've said many times that's an indictment of what they were being paid beforehand, but that's a conversation we're not going to have as a country. So I guess we'll proceed with this. So is it the economic thing? And they're, of course, ignoring, and I understand why, the fact that they're saying not only should these people go back to work, but there should not be any mask mandate. It should be totally up to the individual whether they wear masks. Their corporation should be protected from lawsuits if they create an environment that is unsafe and people get sick or possibly die. So all of these things having to do with maintaining the health of the worker and the health of their family and friends, we're going to do nothing in that. In fact, we're going to undercut any efforts to create a safe work environment. Then we're going to strip away the money and try to make you so economically anxious, so worried about losing everything, that you'll go back to that dangerous situation that we've set up for you. I guess they don't want any of these people to vote for them. I guess in an election they've decided that we don't need literally 1% of the working class to vote for us, because the message they're sending seems to me to be pretty clear.
And small business owners, if that's who they're after, many of those who are polled say, I understand. I understand why my employee still wants to stay out, and I get it. Many of them have said that because it's understandable, and not that they're going to pay them more when they get back, but let's get back to normal again. And this is the bridge to getting back to normal for so many people who would otherwise just, you know, fall out of into bad credit and be put on the street. It's just a terrible, terrible idea.
So I know that we've been talking throughout this episode about strategy, about, you know, we concentrate on the substance of these moves, but then also how's it going to affect the election? And this seems like a pretty significant one, that they made the decision, okay, we're not going to actually fight the virus. We're just going to pretend that it's gone away and roll the dice. And maybe it'll work. Maybe it will go away when the weather gets warmer. That clearly hasn't happened, because cases went up and then hospitalizations went up and now deaths are going up. And there's every reason to believe that we're going to slide into the election with 1,000 to 2,000 plus people dying every day. That's obviously hurt him in the past. He's now locking that into, that's the situation we're going to have. Economically, the fact that so many people lost their jobs clearly hasn't been good for him, and they're making economic decisions that are going to cause catastrophes leading up to the election. More people are going to lose their jobs. People are going to be evicted. They're going to be on the street. They're going to be losing their homes. How is this a strategy to try to create utter chaos in terms of public health and the economy?
The Trump campaign is trying to hold on to voters who voted for them in 2016, who are going to vote for Biden or leaning toward voting for Biden. Those voters are not the people, generally speaking, who would be part of this catastrophe. They are generally suburban, independent voters who like small government. That's what they're banking on with this, that if you give fewer handouts and you give smaller government, that you're going to, you know, those are the, they're going to be supported by those voters. There's also desperation here, because this is a desperate measure. And this isn't all Donald Trump either. This is the Republicans in the Senate who are talking about this. So there's desperation here, making a Hail Mary pass for some of those voters to come back to the president and come back to Republican senators, because they are middle class voters, often suburban, and they're small business owners. And those are the ones that would be in favor of something like this. But it's not going to, I can't see that it is going to be successful. And I think it's too marginal. It's too, they're going for a voter in a very, very precise way. I don't think precision is going to work here.
But isn't, you know, I'm pulling these numbers out of, I think I heard them in the past couple of days, but I believe that suburban voters went for Trump by like 4 points in 2016. And I think that recent polls have Biden up by like 14 or 15 points with that group. Is this a strategy to get that group back after months of a strategy that doesn't seem to be working?
Certainly to stem the losses, right? I mean, and there, that's where the margins are in this election, it would seem, according to pollsters. And I don't know those exact numbers. And in 2018, the suburban voters, that's where you really saw them leaving, especially women. And I don't think, you know, when you look at the percentages of small businesses that are owned by women versus men, I don't even think that it's enough of a group of people that would find this appealing. And then you also have the sympathies of small business owners, too, to play with. So not that they don't see this is a black and white down the line, decision that they're making or situation. They see the humanity of their employees and how they're getting more money and they can't make it without it. They also can't employ them to the same level of hours and opportunity. Yeah. And they can promise that it's going to go forward. It seems a fool's really, really foolish, but maybe it's just a negotiating ploy on other things like payroll tax credits and that. And if that's the case, if it's a negotiating ploy, then let's see where it is at the end of next week.
Yeah, and look, if that if that's what it is, it's not that we actually want to give people just $100, but we want to threaten to give them just $100. It is on the Democrats to make sure that everyone knows that that is how they are negotiating, that they're putting the squeeze not on the virus, but on the people who are worst off right now during the pandemic.
Well, it's also on the Democrats to fight it and fight it vocally. It gives them an opportunity, which is kind of nice, too, to say, hey, look, we're trying to get you every dollar that we can. And, yeah, you know, it also gives them room that if they have to compromise to 500 or 400, hey, look, they were at 100 and we fought to get you 400 or 500. So it does do a favor to the Democrats.
Yeah, I think that it would be a great time for them to, you know, bring up legislation creating the $2,000 UBI throughout the entirety of the pandemic that's been talked about. If you're going to negotiate with $100, here, we're going to negotiate with $2,000. Let's see what the people think.
Wouldn't hold your breath on that one, though.
Yeah, I wouldn't either. Not with this Congress, but, you know, we're working on it. I'm very excited to welcome to the program comedian, activist, musician, reality television personality, and winner of RuPaul's Drag Race Season 8, Bob the Drag Queen. Welcome to the Damage Report.
Hi, how are you?
You know, I'm doing about as well as anyone could be expected to, considering this year. What about yourself?
Same. I mean, I always say all things considered, I'm doing well.
Exactly. Yeah, I think that's a healthy perspective. We've got a lot of different things that we want to talk about with you. But before we launch into the specifics, can you tell us a little bit about your background in political activism, how you got into some of the issues that you're organizing around and advocating for?
Well, I mean, my journey into activism was centered around this group I used to be a part of called Drag Queen Weddings for Equality, which led me to this other group called Queer Rising. We used to do these demonstrations. We used to do these demonstrations in Times Square every Saturday about disparities in the queer community and the straight community. And we would do these full conversations and demonstrations and hand out paperwork. And then I started moving into slightly more radical forms of activism with getting arrested and blocking traffic. And so that was my beginnings with activism.
Okay, well, I know, you know, through much of this year, some of that sort of in-person organizing has been made a little bit more difficult, but I know that you've been adapting by holding things like the first annual Black Queer Town Hall on your YouTube page. Can you tell me about that event?
Yeah, so Black Queer Town Hall was, you know, me and my friend Peppermint were having these discussions like every night about injustices in the Black community, specifically the Black queer community. And then I saw Obama did a town hall, and I remember thinking to myself, like, oh my goodness, like, it's so great to see this. I wish there was someone speaking specifically to me and my Black queerness, been doing a town hall. And I was like, well, I'm sure someone else would want to see that, so I organized it myself.
That's awesome. And so what are some of the things that ended up being discussed at the event?
So we had some great panels with discussions. We had everyone from MJ Rodriguez from Pose. We had Monet Exchange, Peppermint, Todrick Hall, Laverne Cox, Isis King, Basit. We had so many great people joining us in these conversations. We talked about things like being Black while trans, like what it's like to be Black and trans within the Black Lives Matter movement. We talked about tokenism in the Black community. We talked about what do we do now? What do we do now that this movement is getting a big resurgence? How do we keep that way of going and keep justice as a steady flow throughout America?
That's awesome. And I'd love to focus on a couple of the different topics that you just mentioned there. With perhaps the first being in terms of the media talking about the trans community, the issues that it faces, I've always been struck by that I see more of that conversation going on in the past few years, but a lot of it is taking place on the right, focusing on what they see to be sort of divisive social issues that they think are beneficial to focus on, you know, like demonizing trans, like participation in college sports and things like that. Tell me a little bit about the media coverage of the community, some of the misconceptions that you've dealt with.
Well, I mean, I'm really intrigued by the idea that I think the word fear-mongering is appropriate in this place. There's this idea that there are these people from the left trying to, you know, take the rights away from people on the right, or that trans people are trying to sneak into sports and beat your children up at wrestling, and that's what the trans agenda is, or that the trans agenda is somehow has something to do with you know, sneaking into bathrooms and misbehaving in there. When I think anyone who knows a trans person knows that that's not quite the case.
Yeah. Yeah, 100%.
But what it is appealing to the most easily manipulated human emotion, which is fear. And that's why they do it.
Yeah. Yeah, unfortunately, and it seems, you know, many of them, you know, I see Tucker Carlson relatively frequently talks about the trans community, almost never has an individual from the community on the show, and is almost always demonizing. And it's unfortunate to see that and to not see much balance in that. But I want to talk about what are some of the things that, I mean, you had the Black Queer Town Hall, like focusing specifically on that as opposed to, for instance, non-black, the queer community, or for instance, you talked about, you know, having an acknowledgement of the issues that affect the trans community, but specifically the Black trans community. Tell me a little bit about some of what you feel like isn't either understood or acknowledged or talked about enough in the specific experiences of those communities.
Well, the reason why I'm focusing on the Black queer community instead of just the queer community in general, like there comes a point where like often when people of color want to talk about their specific experiences, there is this moment where people are like to say, well, what about this? What about us? What about the white people who are queer who are also experiencing so and so? I mean, the best analogy I've ever seen was someone said that's like going to a march for breast cancer and being like, yeah, but don't forget about diabetes. Yeah. Like, don't forget diabetes is fully still a thing. And it's like, yeah, no one said that. No one's talking about that. This is what we're talking about at this moment.
Yeah. And you know, I'm curious. I believe that you were on The Conversation with Adrian Lawrence just a few weeks ago on our network. And I think some of what's been going on in terms of the civil rights protests was talked about. It seems like over the past few months there's been quite a bit of acknowledgement and representation in these protests for specifically acknowledging that Black trans lives matter. Has that been your perception? Would you like to see more inclusion of the specific concerns of that community during these protests?
Yeah, I want to see way more of it. I mean, I think that what we need is not just a bunch of like queer people saying it, but what we need is like cisgender straight Black men to be saying this as well. We need it. It can't just come from within. It has to come from without as well. So the support for the Black trans community has to come from, we need like Jay-Z and Lil Wayne and Barack Obama and all these like big names, because these are the people that like straight Black men look up to.
Yeah.
And we need them to join the movement.
Do you see any signs that might be happening?
Yeah, a little bit. I mean, the fact that we have like Dwayne Wade, who has a trans child who's speaking out favorably, that's huge. It is both profound and it is huge.
Yeah, yeah.
But we need more of that.
Mm-hmm. And you know, obviously, you know, speaking as someone and not in the community, but having, you know, the minor media platform that I have, as being a part of the media, what can I do to help?
I think uplifting Black voices, uplifting queer voices, uplifting trans voices. I think that, you know, where I'm sitting here, maybe you could have a Black trans woman. Maybe sitting here, you could have a Black trans man give their experience of what it is. Instead of you and I assuming what the experience is, you could have a Black trans person sitting here and telling you.
Yeah.
Well, I have a long list of Black trans people I could sit your way.
I would actually very much appreciate that. Thank you. I also wanted to, continue.
I just said, of course, I can recommend my dear friend Mila Jam. I can recommend Peppermint. I can recommend Shea Diamond. I can recommend Teek Milan. I'll send you a list of them.
Awesome, thank you. I know we do appreciate that. I also want to talk about some of your recent work. You know, I know that you had a recent Esquire interview where you talked about your big move and some of the ways that's changed the way that you think about groups of people moving from New York down to the South. Can you tell us a little bit about that experience?
Well, I mean, I live in New York City. I have lived here for 12 years now. And my experience with, like, specifically working with like the show We're Here and traveling back to the South, I actually have this whole discussion. I have to move in like 2 months, basically. I have to move and I'm like deciding where I'm going to move, if I'm going to stay in New York, if I'm going to go back home to Atlanta, if I'm going to go over to Los Angeles, maybe. And it's been like stress, really stressing me out a lot.
I can understand.
And for more reason than one. But the idea of like when you're queer, you have to consider more than just where you're moving. Like, it's not just I'm moving to the South. It's like, where am I moving? When I feel safe, when I feel protected.
Yeah. I can't imagine. It's got to be incredibly difficult. And you mentioned there also, we're here, where you go across the country recruiting people from these small towns to participate in a one night only drag performance. Tell me a little bit about that.
So We're Here is a show that I'm really excited to be a part of. It's on HBO, and we go into these towns, and I think people think it's a makeover show. That's a common misconception. It's not like, you know, Queer Eye or one of those kind of shows. And by the way, those shows are great and hugely impactful to the queer community. This show is more so, yeah, we like the stuff that we're leaving town with. When we leave town, you can't really use the stuff we left you with. Like, what are you gonna do with this orange wig and this one of a kind outfit? It's not gonna, like, you know, change. But it's really more so about the experience and uplifting queer voices and marginalized voices. I'm so proud that we have highlighted Indigenous people and trans people and Black people and Latinx people and Asian people. Like, really are, in my opinion, doing a really great job at uplifting marginalized voices, especially in these small towns where they feel unheard.
Yeah. And you know, while you were doing the filming, did anything happen in one of these towns that really surprised you? Anything about the reception or the process of actually organizing the events?
Yeah, I was really surprised when I got to Twin Falls, Idaho, and found out there was a big drag community. I was like, oh my God, there's like a drag community here with a hierarchy and everything. I was, you know, I'm always lovingly surprised when I see how many people show up to see us in these towns. It's always overwhelming and a great thing.
Yeah. You know, it seems like you mentioned some of the other shows, you know, dissimilar from yours in a variety of ways. And it seems like it's becoming a little bit more common. You acknowledged how important those shows have been to the community. Oh, yeah. Do you think that, like, it's becoming far more normalized that you're gonna see, like, you talked about, like, people might immediately think that your show is one kind of thing, that it's about a makeover, but it's not really about that you can have these subtle variations. That are you expecting to see a proliferation of that, you know, with streaming services and all of that?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm not the Nostradamus of TV. I can't tell you what's gonna happen next. But I do hope, I mean, I don't know that this format needs to happen for everyone, but what I would love that people to echo from this show and other shows too, by the way, is inclusion in what you see on TV. Like, the noting that representation matters. And when you go out and you do your casting, consider that there is an Indigenous person who watches your show who needs to see a reflection of themselves. Consider there is a trans person who might be watching your show who needs to see a reflection of themselves as well. So I hope that is a trend that echoes throughout the cosmos. And it's something I'm really proud to say that I've been a part of many shows like that. Black Lady Sketch Show on HBO, RuPaul's Drag Race on VH1, also Tales of the City on Netflix. I'm really lucky to be a part of such something that a person like me gets cast when you are on a show that's specifically cast diversely. Mm.
And, you know, I'm sure that people watching this get the impression that you've been involved in a lot of projects. Do you have anything upcoming that you'd like to let people know about?
Well, I mean, as of right now, I'm just working on, you know, doing season two of We're Here, revving up for season two, which is really, really exciting. And I'm also trying to, you know, prepare some future plans, which hasn't been finalized yet. But for right now, I'm focusing most of my energy on We're Here season two.
Okay. Bob the Drag Queen, thank you so much for joining us. Really do appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.